This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amir Sayed Abdi, the host of the channel. Today, I have the pleasure to talk to Dr. Stine Gunder Strom-Krogager and Dr. Jonathan Lear about their book, Research Methods in Digital Food Studies, which was just published in 2021 by Routledge. Stine is Associate Professor at the Department of Communication and Psychology, Aalborg University, Denmark. She has published on food, gender, and methodologies in multiple journals, and she's also the editor-in-chief at the Nordic journal Mediekultur, Journal of Media and Communication Research. Jonathan is head of food and tourism research at the University College Absalon, Denmark, and has published widely on food culture, including food and age and alternative food politics, and previously edited the anthology Food and Media. Stine and Jonathan, thanks for accepting my invitation and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
To start off, could you please tell us a bit about your personal and also research background, starting with you, Stine, if you don't mind?
Yeah. I got my master's degree in media and communication in 2007. Then I did a PhD from 2009 to 12 on children and young people's use of media and food in their everyday lives. And as you just said, since then, I have done research in the areas of food, aesthetics, gender, and methodologies. Yeah.
Thank you, Stine. Jonathan?
Yeah, so I'm actually from literary studies and cultural studies and French studies. And then I finished in 2008 with all these kind of degrees and then moved on to the PhD at Copenhagen University, where I wrote about food and masculinity among celebrity chefs in European food media. And after that, I've been working in the University of Aarhus, also in Denmark, where I studied food, the new Nordic cuisine, food and pedagogies, food and media. And then in 2018, I moved on to the position I hold now, as you mentioned, where I'm head of a small research unit in food and tourism studies, where we also work with food design, food and sustainability, food tourism, and so on. And then, of course, food and media is still one of my big interests.
Of course. And there's often a story behind, you know, every book. What's the story behind yours, and how did this book come about?
For some years, you know, we have noted, both of us, that there was a lot of focus on digital media, that it changed radically our relationship to food in the everyday, and also that food had become a predominant topic in digital and social media. Already, like when I did my PhD, there was a lot of focus on food television 10 years ago, but since then it's really kind of exploded with all kinds of new medias and also really different forms of medias, and also, of course, including new kinds of food media producers. A lot of the social media is like accessible to a lot of people, and a lot of people try also not only to consume the media, but also to be producers in different ways. And also when it comes to food culture, the way we look at shopping, the way we go to the sociality around the table and so on, it's still something that has been changed a lot with the arrival of digital media. And in the research, we have seen some new books, some new research, but the study on digital food also raises a lot of methodological questions, because there is so much of it, and it's kind of new ways of thinking about it in terms of the relationship between those who produce and those who consume it. And also, I think an important part is that we needed really to rethink the traditional methods in media studies, of course, which have been working a lot with this, but also in food studies, because media and digital communication is so important all around food. So what we wanted to do was to kind of make up for the lack of should we say, guides in how to do digital food studies. So that's like a practical dimension, because a lot of the methodology was not really developed a lot. I think there was done some very interesting work, but maybe the methodological parts of it was still could be described more in detail, also to inspire more studies. And then we also wanted to raise awareness and discussion of the potential problems and ethics of digital food studies in terms of what we do as scholars and food studies researchers.
So concretely, we just went out, asked a series of renowned authors in digital food studies to describe their methodological approaches to the field and share their reflections. So they should not go out and do new empirical work, but reflect on what they have been doing previously. And we were lucky that all of them agreed. And we feel that they actually really welcome this opportunity, as we are all kind of new in and also a bit unexperienced in this digital field, and some of us maybe a bit out of our comfort zone. So we ask them to reflect on what they had been doing and put it into this very concrete form in each chapter. To make it very accessible, especially to students.
Thank you. And there's a couple of follow-up questions that I would like to ask. You mentioned, Jonathan, that there were some, you know, challenges and potentials and opportunities, some methodological challenges. What are some of these, you know, challenges and opportunities when we're talking about, you know, digital era of food studies?
Well, I think a lot of the challenges are, if you take something very concretely, as when I did my PhD, I focused a lot on food television. And it was, for instance, at that period, 10 years ago, it was kind of possible for me to kind of lock and categorize all kind of food shows shown in Denmark, for instance. That there was a lot of it. It has expanded immensely compared to the previous years. But it was, at the same time, should we say, it was possible to do it. Whereas now, if you have YouTube, for instance, which is like this huge domain, this huge archive, constantly renewed in terms of what's going on there, then I could never log in any meaningful way everything that is going on there. So that's, for instance, a problem of how do we do samples in a way that makes sense, in a way that We can choose the examples we want to do for our analysis. And that is, I think, a very a big challenge. There is so much food media text out there, and it's also constantly changing. And it could change from one day to another as well. We just follow specific stories of cases and so on. It's added on also in terms of comments and so on. So also, we have to rethink the very concept of what is a text, because if you buy a cookbook, you have a physical object and it stays the same, whereas any kind of text in the digital world of YouTube video could be taken off the grid. It could be reposted. It could be commented upon. It could be liked and so on. And all these kind of thing kind of does that we should maybe see text, not talks about text as something stable, unique, but rather as different kind of textual practices. And that kind of forces us also to radically rethink the very term of what is a textual analysis when we think about it in the digital world.
That's really interesting, and I would like to come back to that a bit later. But before that, I would like to follow up on something that Sina said. There have been other books on this topic, especially in the past couple of years, like, for example, Deborah Lipton and Zena Fieldman's Digital Food Culture, or Tanya Lewis's Digital Food, or Digital Food Activism by, you know, Tanya Schneider, Karen Eli, and Catherine Dolan, or Alain Presswood's work on digital domestics. And some of these scholars, as you mentioned, Sina, have in fact a chapter in your book. And what distinguishes your work from all these is an emphasis on, as you said, methodological dimensions of food studies. But the question that I have is that one of the challenges that I'm assuming that editors of an edited volume usually face is thematizing the chapter to give the book a sort of themed structure, because you get all sorts of papers from, you know, all sorts of people who are from all sorts of disciplines. So what themes have you come up with at the end, and what do you discuss in each, you know, section of the book, very generally speaking?
Yeah, we have these four parts in the book. Where we move from this more text-centered focus to a more practice-oriented and more non-media-centric focus. In the first part, we deal with textual analysis as these old methods, if you can say that, now handling new kinds of texts. Then we have the second part, which is on digital ethnography, dealing with different areas within this field. Then we have a part three that is on users' practices. Here we have, for example, a chapter by Jonathan on action research. And then we have a last part on digital archives and network analysis. So we have the first two parts are the biggest parts, because this is what most of the research out there is about or handling, and also that it made sense to have different kinds of perspectives on these two parts. So we have four parts, and all chapters are kind of built up in the same way to make it very accessible for students, as I said before, and a very hands-on way of reading a chapter that outlines how to do this particular method. And then following in the end, we have these pedagogical features, do's and don'ts, for example, questions for reflection, a small box called Now You Try, which is a concrete question where people can dive into this method. And also we have further readings and ethical considerations as these elements that are in all chapters.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Unfortunately, as much as I like, we don't have time to delve into each of these chapters, but and all of which, you know, sound very interesting, but we do definitely have time to discuss your own chapter, Stine. You have a chapter co-authored with Thomas Simonsen on approaching food texts on YouTube. And this is interesting, especially because of what Jonathan mentioned earlier about texts, because 30 years ago, it was very clear what the text is. But now, and in the context of social media, that has completely changed. So could you give us an overview of the chapter and what you discuss in it?
Yeah, because as you said, YouTube is exactly this great example of how digital media poses this challenge in regard to the amounts of data that we have to handle and also to choose analytical examples from. So I can go to YouTube and find the first video when I search for food videos. However, I have no idea if this is the most seen or highest ranked. Then you can go and filter your search. But the most interesting thing here is how to approach these huge amounts of data. And how to sample when you want to work with something from, for example, YouTube. Also in terms of how to select and identify both relevant and also representative data. And in regards to YouTube, this platform has been studied from two methodologically different angles. On the one hand, there's a qualitative and small scale study versus this quantitative and very large scale platform study. And this chapter that Thomas and I did is an example of a qualitative driven case study of this food channel, Tasty. And thus, it's also this contextual investigation of food channels. So what the chapter tries to do is to show how to choose from this huge sample, having in mind that we will never fully know the underlying algorithms of this platform. And that applies to any other social media platform that we work with in the digital landscape.
Thank you, Stine. And Jonathan, your chapter is on using digital media in food-related action research. Could you give us an overview of the chapter, please?
Yeah, I would love to. So my chapters, like from the part of the book where we talk more about users' practices. So as Dina mentioned, this kind of move that we see throughout the book from the focus on how to rethink textual analysis to moving on to like a kind of non-media centric perspective, or where we see the media in relation to practices, or rather how practices and media practices, food practices and media practice are interrelated. And this is actually from a project I did a few years ago when I was at the Pedagogical University of Denmark, University of Aarhus. And here we had a project on how to improve meals in Danish daycare institution. The government wanted to change the focus from this just being a space for refueling, a time for refueling, the meal time, and turning it into a space for learning and making children aware of their senses, their agency, and the social aspects of the meal. And what we did was roughly 10 institutions that was integrated in different kind of labs where we met with the practitioners. And I was responsible for a lab on taste pedagogies. And in this lab, we met 10 times during a year. And for each session in the lab, we asked the practitioners to film their practices on digital devices and then show them at these sessions where the other practitioners were there and some of our scholars as well. And then we kind of discussed what could be changed. And it was very interesting because a lot of the things that the adults, the pedagogical staff said they did, when we filmed it in the institution, the setting, we saw that was not what was going on. And they actually filmed each other, and you could see that they wanted to give a lot more agency to the children. And they actually thought they had done that. But when we saw these videos, it was quite obvious that they did not, that they were that was surveying the kids, monitoring their every move, and they didn't have much liberty to actually practice this agency. So that's very briefly what the project was about, and it inspires new guidelines by the Danish Food Administration, opening to more to new kind of approaches to meals. And then there was a lot of examples also from these kind of innovative approaches that we saw was fulfilled there. And I think it's a strong case for like using digital media in a tool for action research projects. So these action research projects is when we both want to do research and change practice out in the real world at the same time. So we should have different kind of outputs and different kind of attention points. And maybe there are also different kind of agendas. But I thought here it was very interesting to see how it was the digital media was a tool to show what was actually done rather than what people said they did. Because if we had just interviewed them, we wouldn't have had the same kind of data. It wouldn't have shown us exactly what was going on. And I also think this way of documenting practices offered a new voice to some of the people who might otherwise have some difficulty in formulating this in their practice in writing. And I think that was pretty interesting. But at the same time, of course, as with all this kind of novel practices also, you know, where you research and practices out in the real world, it's also complicated and it's messy, and there are still hierarchies, and it could also, I read a little about this in the end, a lot of things could have been done differently. For instance, what if we have given the children a digital camera to kind of see what was going on and to get a better view of their perspective? So like many of the chapters, it's also, I think, a work in progress. None of us are completely 100% experts, but rather it's we're going into some new worlds and exploring them with all the messiness there is in there. And that's also, I think, one of the great things in the books, that a lot of very interesting reflections from people really trying out new methods.
Yes, indeed. Your book, as I could tell from several chapters in it, has a strong focus on food activism in digital contexts. I was wondering how digital food activism looks like, or how does digital era bring about structural changes and sort of new potentials to these sorts of collective activism and food movements?
Yeah, that is a very, very good question. And you mentioned Tanya Schneider and Karen Ellie's anthology, which they co-edited a couple of years ago, which is called Digital Food Activism, which is a very interesting volume and very important. They also talk a lot about that in their chapter in our book and reflect on the methods used there. And digital food activism can take many forms. It can go from like just being online discussion, raising political, social issues. It can also be digital platform where you organize consumers or new apps for alternative consumption, like we have here in Denmark, the Too Good To Go app. I'm not sure if everyone is familiar with that, but that's a food waste app. So where different kind of restaurants or food shops or bakeries can sign up. And then when they have some leftover food, they can send out a notification in the app, and if you're in the area, you can then go and pick up the food for a lower price. But then maybe with certain, you may not have the same free choice as you would if you go in as a kind of ordinary customer. Another example of this kind of app-tivism, which is also another word for it, where you use the apps, is the Parabera Forum, which is a gender and feminist app focusing on gender inequality in the restaurant business. And they propose for different cities, I think mainly in Europe, to give a guide to where you should go if you want to eat in restaurants, cafe, or bakeries that are run by women. So kind of giving a visibility to certain female actors in the food scene locally. And one of the good things about the digital world and era is that it's pretty easy to organize. to organize a lot of people a very short time in a very around issues that are timely, that are central, and you also sometimes niche where you can get a hold of a lot of people, which might have been very difficult to do otherwise. And you can get these kind of big change the public debate or build up new infrastructure as an alternative to the mainstream capitalism or supermarket or food systems that you have. On the downside to that, as they also mention, a lot of the people writing on this, is that it could also be considered a kind of a lazy form of activism, right? It's easier to be a part of a hashtag activist movement, right? To just write something on Twitter and put on a hashtag. But it can also be extremely powerful, but sometimes it might also be, should we say, the lazy way of going about activism, where people then forget about going in the street, about putting action behind their ideals. So it's also very complicated and rather messy, should we say, way it's difficult to say what it is, to put the boundaries exactly, and at the same time also have very different kinds of impact on the way we eat and on the politics of food.
Thank you, Jonathan. Most books on food nowadays, or at least the ones I have come across, have a final chapter that deals with the future of food. And your book is not an exception in this regard, with the chapter that has been written by the one and only Deborah Lupton. So how do you think the future of digital food studies look like?
Well, of course, we think that a lot more research on digital media and everyday food lives is coming. And we also hope and think that there will be more integration of digital and non-digital food studies. Because even though we make this book because we live in a digital world now and we need new methodologies to grasp and handle these new digital platforms, we still fall back to or are informed by the old methods, if you can say that, that we've been using for ages now. So it would be great for digital food studies to be more integrated with all the work that has been done previous before the digital era came. So I think that would be great if it wouldn't be kind of this sharp distinction between pre-digital and digital.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Sina. There's obviously a lot more in the book, and I encourage listeners to pick up a copy. But before we wrap up the interview, I'd like to ask whether you're working on something right now, or are you thinking about doing a research on a particular topic in the near future, starting with you, Sina?
Yeah, we are actually right now beginning to dive into our project together. On food porn and trying to find out how to make this book because it's obviously another book than this anthology on methods. So mm-hmm. that will be one of our next steps. I'll also be working with sustainability in food. I don't know quite where in this field yet, but I'll be going in that direction.
Okay. That's really exciting. Can't wait to read it whenever it comes out. And Jonathan, apart from the book that you're working on with Sina, is there any project that you're doing right now or are thinking about doing in the future?
So it's still, I think, going to be a lot within the digital. And I have a project we just got funding for by the Danish Independent Research Council, which is called Masculinities in Green Transition, which is a project then on how men react or embrace or fail to embrace, which is often the case, the green transition, and men seems to also to be less likely than women to be a part of these kind of new alternative practices that should help us go into a greener future. And that project is both a part of it. One of the sub projects is on interviews with men and how they relate to their everyday lives in around sustainable practices. It's in not only food, but it could also be in transportation and in travel and the leisure time and so on. And the second part is then on masculinities in different kind of forums relating online forums relating to sustainability, and see how both the green masculinity might look like online, but also where we see the resistance by men performed in opposition to what is going on with the green transition and so on. So that's really also a project, as Stina just mentioned, with the combining the digital and the non-digital as a way of understanding contemporary lifestyles and food practices.
Sounds like a very interesting project, Jonathan. Do you have any further comments, anything you want to add before we wrap up the interview?
Well, maybe just that this book is just a first step on a long journey into the digital food landscape, and we hope that people will use it and find it useful and use it the way that they find that it's relevant for. So, yeah.
Yeah, first the steps are usually the most important steps, Stine, as they say.
Yeah.
Yes. We hope so.
Yes. Jonathan, anything you want to add? Or?
No, exactly. I think like what Stine said, it's very important also to see that this is not the end of methodology in digital food studies. I think people should look it up and make it their own. Yes. and do a lot of studies. I hope we have made it easier to begin and do these first steps, and then we can really build up a large corpus of new inspiring studies on digital food studies.
Thank you to both for taking this first step. And thank you so much for coming on the show and speaking with me today and sharing your insight and your very interesting work with our listeners. It was an absolute pleasure.
No, thank you for having us.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Yeah.
Bye.